Welcome to the Pseudo One Planner podcast. Today, we're going to talk about how to strategize for borrowing for the cost of school before you do it. So much of our stuff talks about what to do with your student loans after school. And I thought I would have my colleague and good friend, Megan Landris, another student loan planner consultant on the pod today to help me talk through this. Hey, Megan, how you doing?
Hey, I'm good. Thanks for having me again.
So, you're in Georgia and I'm in St. Louis. So St. Louis, when we're recording this, is just starting to get back into the swing of things. You guys were going out to restaurants in the middle of the pandemic, right? So what's going on down there in Georgia right now?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people were mad at our state for being one of the first to open or slowly open, I guess. I think what's interesting is, I mean, there are restaurants opening and there's stores opening back up, but people aren't going out. I think people are still being really conservative or safe, I guess, with making sure that they're taking care of themselves and their health. And I live in the Battery by the Braves Stadium, and there's a lot of restaurants here that were closed for a long time or just doing takeout. Now they're generally, it seems like they're all back open, but it's still like dead. This area is supposed to be a really populated, up and going area, especially with Braves season being now, but it's still pretty quiet. So that's what I've been noticing.
I don't know. St. Louis is a rager right now.
Really?
So, no, I'm just kidding a little bit. I mean, so I'll say this. There's certain parts of like our region that are like raging. The boating. Did you see like a couple weeks ago on the news? There was that like Lake of the Ozarks pool party that like made the rounds like all over national media. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I didn't see it.
Lake of the Ozarks is kind of the big party area for our region. It's where everybody takes their, you know, fancy boat and sits on the deck and fishes and drinks Bud Light and waves the American flag. I'm joking around a little bit, but it's kind of like that. And and so there was this one bar that had people just like jam packed together, you know, shoulder to shoulder in a pool party environment. Yeah, it looked like spring break, except it was like not close to the beginning of the pandemic. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think that, you know, just is just a crazy time to be alive. So
right,
it's always kind of interesting to compare what life is like for different people. One of my things I'll ask clients is just like, hey, how is it where you are right now? I mean, it's just real fascinating to hear different people's stories about like what life is like where they live, because it's so like locally dependent right now, you know?
It is. Yeah. I had a consult recently who told me she was up north. I'm trying to remember the state. I probably won't on the spot, but she was saying that her governor was opening the state around the time when Georgia was opening back up, and people were not happy about it. They were really upset or really maybe nervous about it. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Georgia seems happy about it, but no one's really going out still.
Yeah, it makes sense. So we're going to talk today about what to do like before you borrow, you know? So I did talk a little bit in the beginning about how we're so focused on people that already have the debt, but we do have a pre-debt consult, and we do have a lot of knowledge about planning for student loans before you take them out so you can strategically borrow and know what you're getting yourself into. The first thing I wanted to talk about is cost of attendance. So there's this requirement in the Higher Education Act that schools disclose cost of attendance. What would be some ways that somebody could find the cost of attendance for a program they're looking at going to?
Well, Google can be our best friend. You can Google cost of attendance for the school or the schools you're looking into maybe entertaining going to in the program. And there will be some type of maybe itemized list. And maybe you're better at knowing what these things look like, but are they typically itemized to where they list out tuition, fees, things like that? Or is it more so like a lump sum that you typically see?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the school. So some of them are really good about listing out 23 line items, and other ones will just be like room and board and miscellaneous, and then like tuition and fees. And, you know, I mean, it's always kind of interesting because I did some research like back in the day, like I was trying to put together a master list of the costs for every graduate program I could find. And that was just like way too much.
That's a lot.
Well, yeah, I abandoned it, right? It was like, I got through like dentistry and then like vet school, where like there's only like, you know, a few dozen programs for each one. And then I got to like pharmacy and there's like a gazillion, and I'm just like, all right, I'm done.
Right.
And it's funny, I was like so detailed with my Excel spreadsheet, and then I got to listing. Instead of listing the cost, I was just like, freaking expensive. And I just copy paste it. You know? So the different schools will be different levels of honest about it too. For example, Midwestern is one of the schools. Midwestern University is one that is very expensive for most of their programs, but they're pretty honest about the disclosures. Like they put in their cost of attendance, it's like, expect tuition prices to rise 5% every year. They literally say it in the cost of attendance. And I'm like, that's refreshing. I mean, super expensive and probably not justifiable to raise tuition like that, but at least you're being honest and telling everybody about it. And they put the loan fees in there too. And it's not just like the sanitized loan fees. A lot of places will just take the Stafford loan fees of 1% and say, here's your loan fees. But they put in the full grad plus 4.25% origination fee. They put in all of it. And the only thing that none of the schools do, none of the schools include the accrued interest that you're going to leave with. That's something that I think should be required to be included in cost of attendance, because it is a cost. It's not like you can avoid it. They always list the cost of attendance, which is good to know if you're paying cash. But if you're paying cash, you're probably not going on the cost of attendance website to try to look up what the cost is going to be. You're just like, dollar bills. I'm going to pay for it. Dad and mom are going to cut a check and then I'm good, right? I think the people who are price sensitive are not the ones paying cash, is just my guess. So I really think that cost of attendance should be required to disclose accrued interest, because everybody knows what it's going to be. It's not like it's a mystery. Like, I mean, you know, it's going to be within 5 to 8% interest rate, right? So just assume, you know, 6% or something, and then just multiply all the costs of the accrued interest based off of what's listed if you borrowed the full amount, and just disclose to kids what you're really going to have. That would cause some people to make some different decisions with their higher education, which is why the schools don't do it. So you're never going to see voluntary disclosure that's in the financial disinterest of schools to do. You're just not going to see that without legislation.
Cost of attendance might already feel or look kind of bad, but, you know, add in what the real cost is going to be over time or post-graduation. Oh, man. Of course, they don't want to disclose that number.
Oh, yeah. So let's talk about undergrad for a little bit. Our truest, strongest expertise is in Grad Plus, Parent Plus, Stafford Unsubsidized, that kind of loans. You know, when you start talking about expected family contribution and FAFSA for undergrads and Pell Grants, you know, I'll admit that that's a little bit outside of our element, because, you know, we're typically dealing with people with the largest student loan balances, which you typically need to have some sort of PLUS loan or Stafford Unsubsidized loan to get a large enough balance to need to talk to us, right? But we do know a lot more than your average bear about this, so we're going to talk about it anyway. So this is probably not going to apply to a lot of the people listening, but maybe it'll apply to your kids, right? Or maybe, you know, you have a older sibling who has, you know, high school age kids or something like that, that you could fill them in for this, right? So there's a subsidized and unsubsidized Stafford loan for undergrad. There used to be subsidized for grad school, but they got rid of it. So it's subsidized and unsubsidized for undergrad. You can get a maximum of $23,000 over 4 years total for subsidized student loans. So I'm just going to work through a couple numbers and just try to get your reaction, Megan.
Yeah.
So you can be a dependent on your taxes or independent on your taxes. How did your parents claim you when you were in college?
I was independent pretty quickly after, or once I started school, because I worked full time all the way through my undergrad. So I had my own income coming in. But for school's purposes, it doesn't matter. As long as you're under 24, the age of 24, regardless of if you file taxes independently from your parents or not, you're in the school's eyes considered a dependent student if your parents are still in the picture. So I've found that interesting. I think sometimes people get confused about that because, you know, tax stuff and student loan stuff don't really coincide. Like, dependency status isn't the same. Household size when we're talking about student loan planning is not the same. So that's maybe a little fact that people don't know.
I mean, that's a great point. So, I mean, like, if you're very low income, you can get Pell Grant. So you can get about $6,000 per year for that. And that's mostly going to families with income 20K and less. Although you can make, you know, up to 50K, I think, and still get something. So Pell Grants, that'll cover $6,000. And the average cost of an in-state public university is around $25,000. So you're $19,000 short. So if you're a dependent student, you can borrow $5,500 in the first year, $6,500 in your sophomore year, and then $7,500 for junior and senior year. So that's what the dependent student can get. About $2,000 of that is going to be unsubsidized, and the rest of that would be subsidized. And if you're independent, then you can get an extra $5,000 on top of those numbers in unsubsidized loans. So talk me through, like, how do I figure out if I'm going to get 5,000 something, or if I can get up to the 12,500 amount as an independent junior or senior, what does that process look like?
Yeah, so it does come down. I mean, the FAFSA form is what everyone has to complete as they're going through school. It helps calculate the family contribution towards your school funding. And, you know, that's also where it determines dependent or independent status. If you are deemed to be independent, I think the rules are pretty strenuous. Like, you have to be like not in contact with your parents at all. Or it's not like, you know, your parents don't have money to give you. It's like you literally cannot be in communication with your parents, from what I understand. Like, you have to be basically emancipated in the eyes of that application, where your parents have no influence over your student aid situation to be independent. Because if you're under 24, and those more extreme examples are not the case, you are, in the eyes of the school, still a dependent student. And so the FAFSA form will determine how much aid you are eligible for. It's a really complicated, if you've looked at, maybe I should send this to you, Travis. It's like a really complicated table.
I just Googled it. So a independent student, you have to meet one of the following. You're working on something beyond a bachelor's, which is not an undergrad, right? So you have a child or other legal dependents who receive more than half their financial support from you. So if you're a parent, you are married. That's one of the ones that qualifies. You're at least 24. You're a veteran. You are currently serving on active duty in the armed forces for other than training purposes. So in other words, you're not an ROTC or something like that, I guess, if you're in active duty. Since 13, if both of your parents were deceased, if you're an emancipated child, or if you're homeless. So those are the 9 qualifications where you can be an independent.
Which a lot of people won't qualify for. I mean,
well, isn't that kind of, it's a little, I don't want to say 1950s, but it's kind of.
Kind of, right? Yeah. The marriage.
Yeah. It's like you're not an adult unless you have a kid, or unless you're married, or unless you're old, or unless you're a veteran. Like, those are the only scenarios where you're a real adult.
Yeah. We need to find out when those were written.
Yeah. I mean, like, it definitely kind of seems like it's a little weird, honestly. Touché is so fascinating doing this podcast with you, because I actually a little bit didn't understand that difference that much, to be honest. Because, you know, again, we don't do a ton of the pre-debt work we usually do is for people that are going to graduate programs, and it's a totally different analysis. That's really interesting. So, you know, most people are pretty limited then to that $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 amounts that you can borrow. So that's really quite stringent, because you can really only come out with, what is that, 15 grand plus 12?
27, I think, is the total.
27 plus interest, right? So 27 plus a little bit of interest. So that kind of explains why the average student loan debt's around like 30-ish, 35,000, right? Because you can't really borrow more than that in your name alone. So you've got 6 from Pell Grants if you're very low income, and then you've got, you know, 6 from student loans, so you're at 12, and you need another 13. So that extra 13, maybe there's work study, maybe that gives you a couple thousand. Maybe there's, you know, part-time work that you can get a little bit from. And then you still might need like 5 to 10,000 a year. So what do people turn to when they need an extra 5 to 10,000 a year for funding?
I guess what I've seen most is people tend to turn to the private funding route, because they're focusing on the interest rate. They're focusing on, you know, let's get the lowest interest rate possible. Maybe we could obtain that with private funding. But what people need to realize is private funding has limited repayment options on the back end. And so we might not just want to be thinking about the interest rate. We might want to be thinking about what is that going to look like on the back end, repayment side of things, because sometimes people don't quite realize that once they graduate with both a federal loan and a private loan, you can go on an income-driven plan for your federal loans initially, like getting off started with your career, make that payment proportionate to your income. But your private loan is not taking into account income, or that you have a federal loan in the mix too. And so sometimes that can be tough to handle. But another route you can go is Parent Plus loan funding. And we've talked about this a few times with the double consolidation loophole and how to tackle Parent Plus loans, because they are a little bit more of a bear, but they are federal loans. So there's more repayment options that you could potentially take advantage of and pursue. So that's one route. Well, I guess the two routes you can go: private funding or potentially Parent Plus funding, if you run out of places to go for aid after you've capped out on your own aid.
Yeah, and that's interesting too, because the average parent plus balance in the United States is about 28,000. So, you know, if you take, we said 5 to 10 extra, it's kind of like what you need for an in-state public university, 7 times 4, 28,000, right? So that's right around that range, basically. So, you know, your typical average person is going to need, you know, that 5 to 10K extra to finish school. And so that's probably going to come from parent plus loans in a lot of cases. So that's you know, great point about those private loans. We'll come back to that in a little bit. Some schools offer true merit scholarships. They used to have Perkins loans. I've seen like Stanford has like this alumni loan program where they'll make private loan offers to their, you know, students directly, you know, at pretty low interest rates. So the private loans is interesting, Megan, because those are actually, if you look at the average interest rate of private loans, it's actually really freaking high.
Yeah, I've noticed that definitely more recently with like Sallie Mae. I've seen a lot of people comparing Sallie Mae to Parent Plus loan interest rates right now. And like Sallie Mae is close to 10%, unless you've seen higher.
We have to be careful because there's averages, right? I mean, there's a huge range. Like somebody with a really high credit score might qualify for a very low rate. Somebody with an unproven credit record might qualify for something very high. I think that the reality of private loans is basically it's an unsecured debt, right? And so when you're lending, you know, if you've got a really good FICO score, then they know you're going to pay it back. They know you're good for it. So it's, you know, you're probably going to get like a 5, 6, 7% type of interest rate, like kind of similar to what the government gives, right? If you have an exceptional credit score, you might get something in the fours in some really, you know, amazing circumstances. Like if you're talking pristine, perfect credit for a parent, by the way, not for a kid. Like it's really difficult to get a private loan in your name alone. There's some companies on our site that offer it. You can Google search, like on our site, the search bar, you can search private loans. Like Ascent, for example, is one that will give like a future income driven or income based loan so that you can qualify without a cosigner. So the thing that I see with a lot of private loan companies is like a lot of the financing need is for like untraditional or unusual situations. You know, so for example, DACA recipients might not be able to borrow directly from the federal student loan system in some cases, right? People that don't have their international students, for example, you might need a cosigner. I see a ton of like Citizens Bank cosigned loans for people that were international students that became citizens and they have this big private cosigned loan. They're trying to get their cosigner off the hook for it by refinancing it. And also I see, frankly, like people don't really do the things they're supposed to do in a lot of cases just because it's like confusing. I see a lot of people apply for private loans that just like didn't fill out the FAFSA.
Oh no. Yeah.
It's terrible. It's terrible. But I see it. And if you didn't fill out the FAFSA, then, you know, you have to pay the bill. And the university, the one thing they're really good at is getting paid. And so they have all their people in the financial aid department in a lot of cases that have partnerships with private lenders, and they'll connect you with private lenders so that you can pay the bill, when that's a really damaging thing if you could, you know, have gone for just a bunch of Parent Plus loans instead because of those income-driven protections. So I'm not anti-private loans in every case, but I do think that they have limited applications. If you want to see our kind of view on it, there's a studentloanplanner.com/private page that we have a lot of the private loan companies describe and explain when it makes sense. So let's talk about kids in out-of-state and private school situations. So you need an extra, you know, take what we were talking about, the 25K per year, now add an extra 20 to 40 per year. How do you finance that?
Yeah, so we've been seeing some higher costs for undergraduate programs lately. This probably is not a new thing, but I think, you know, I've been seeing it more frequently lately. And that's a tough situation to be in if you need, in addition to what you can pull out for yourself as the student, you need an additional 20, 25, 30,000 to get you through this program that you're looking into.
Well, people use Parent Plus to finance that, don't they, in most cases?
Yeah.
I mean, explain how that works. Like, what does a parent end up with when you have one or multiple kids that go to an out-of-state or private school? What happens?
Yeah, so Parent Plus loans can be borrowed by the parent. So one or the other, mom or dad, or both. I've seen it happen where both parents kind of split the difference and pull out loans under each of their names. But similar to you know, each semester that you're approved for a loan or unsubsidized or subsidized, you'll typically have two loan types on your own loan file if you're approved for subsidized. If not, you'll just have unsubsidized, typically per semester. Now, parents are the same, so they'll have their own loan list under their own name. And sometimes the misconception with Parent Plus loans is And I hear this all the time that, oh, well, when I look in my Parent PLUS loan portal, you know, my daughter's name is on it or my son's name is on it. So that's their loan. No, it's not. It's going to be yours. It's going to stay yours as long as it's under the federal system. There's no way we can transfer that into the student's name within the Fed system. You can through refinancing, but that's after the fact. Now, Parent PLUS loans, you can borrow more than what you can borrow yourself as the student in undergrad, meaning, you know, there isn't technically a cap for Parent PLUS loans. It's based off of the cost of attendance that the school is telling you it's going to cost. So you can get, or your parents can get approved for up to the cost of attendance minus what you've already received in your own funding. And so that's oftentimes a way that you can more easily access aid because they've run credit for Parent PLUS loans, but the interest rate is not based off of your parents' credit. Federal loans are not based off of credit at all. What they're really looking for, in my opinion, and tell me if you think I'm wrong, but what I think they're looking for is to see if you are, you know, in really bad financial trouble, like if you filed for bankruptcy or, you know, if you've been laundering money. I think that's what they're looking for there. But other than that, it's very easy for a parent to have access to a Parent PLUS loan, regardless of credit.
Yeah. So, you know, in other words, if you are going to, we're comparing, let's say, how about University of Florida versus University of Miami? That's a good example, right? Super expensive private school, fairly low cost in-state university. So you're talking like all in cost, you know, University of Florida, 25 grand, all in cost of going to University of Miami, maybe at 50 or 60. So that extra 25 to 30 grand a year that you need, the parent can take out the loan in their name. And that was a great point, Megan, about how it's the parent's loan. It's not the kid's loan at all. It's not a cosign situation. A lot of like private loans, the kid is on the hook because it's a cosigner situation, right? So the cosigner's on the hook and the kid's on the hook. But, you know, if you have a Parent PLUS loan, you know, you might have agreed, like handshake agreement, yeah, this is the kid's loan. No, it's the parent's loan, period. There's no if, ands, or buts about it. It's the parent's loan. If the kid wanted to, they could disappear to, you know, some far-flung island in the Pacific, you never hear from them again, and it's your loan. They can't come after the kid at all.
Right.
So, I mean, that's something to be a little aware of as a parent, right? We see the, I'm going to get in trouble here, but the Catholic school plan. So the Catholic school, so a lot, you know, very devout Catholics often have like larger families, and then they want their kids to go to like these really nice private Catholic universities, sometimes more expensive. And then you'll borrow for like five kids, and then you'll borrow the maximum amount to cover cost of attendance for each kid. And so that's kind of how we've seen $400,000-$600,000 Parent PLUS balances for individuals because of that. And it's not just, I want to respect the Catholic listeners of this podcast. Okay. I'm hating on you. I'm just giving you an example. Okay. So there's certainly a lot of examples of two kids that a parent borrows for that you can easily have 200 grand in Parent PLUS loans for a two child family, which is the average American family. Three kids, you can have $300,000 or $400,000. So, you know, these large Parent PLUS balances are not specific to any individual or any kind of demographic group. Although I would say that, you know, obviously the larger family size that you have, the larger the debt that the individual parent can end up in, right?
Yeah, if they're putting all of them through school, yeah.
So hopefully, we're not going to get a bunch of angry emails for that. You know, we love all of our listeners, especially those who tend to have larger family sizes. actually, just a funny story. I actually got an email one time that says, "Hey, I think your calculator's broken." I said, "I don't think it is." Well, what's wrong? And he said, "Well, I put my family size in, and it's not giving me any numbers. There's just all these hashtag value."
Did it break it?
It broke it. And I said, "Well, what's your family size?" And the guy said, 15.
Wow.
So I want to say it was something like that. And I was just like, what? Like, what? Can you explain? And he goes, yeah, you know, I just really love my wife or something like that. I don't know. I don't think he said that. But I was just like, okay, well, I didn't put 15 in there. So I think I went back and programmed it for 20, just in case the Duggars, you know, download this new loan planner calculator. But that's not going to protect for the person who had a family size of 93 on that government accountability office report, right? So if you have a family size of 93, I'm sorry, our student loan planner calculator will break. So just some more examples of funding for undergrad, because I do want to talk about grad school. But when I used to be a municipal bond trader, we would get reports from credit analysts that would study universities' financial health because we would consider investing in them. And it was really fascinating because one of the things that the credit analysts would always talk about is tuition discounting. So a lot of these private universities, basically you would look at the level of tuition discounting that a university did, and then that would be a sign of how financially healthy the university was or how financially unhealthy the university was. In other words, a high tuition discount rate where you have to discount 50, 60, 70% off of the sticker price, that was viewed as a negative for the credit for that university. And then a low tuition discount price of, you know, 10% discount tuition, that was viewed as a strong positive. I mean, that's also how some people are able to make it work, is the tuition list price might be super high to make people assume value, and then you discount it half off for most people, and that helps keep the debt amounts down somewhat. Anyhow, a couple other options, and I don't know if you had any of this, Megan, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, but you know, so you can do, if you want to avoid student loans, right? Because we don't talk about that enough. If you want to avoid student loans, you can do a prepaid program, right? Mm-hmm. So for my parents, it was an amazing deal back in the day when I was born. They like pulled up their savings with grandparents and with, you know, close friends, and they just paid like literally a lump sum price that got them full tuition covered for any university where I lived in Florida for like a fixed upfront cost. So, you know, I looked into this. I think back when they did it, the cost for 4 years of school, you know, with the lump sum payment was $3,000, and that was it. So $3,000 when I was born, you know, and it's now $28,000. I mean, so talk about an explosive. I mean, they got an insanely good deal because going to Florida University was just like virtually free when I was born. And so they bought the tuition price today for the future, basically, right? So the $28,000, I mean, that is a lot. Don't get me wrong, but that's also kind of like a new car, you know, and people do buy new cars for their kids, or not for the kids. Well, I guess that's true. They buy them because they want to have more safe SUV, yeah, or something, right? You know, I guess that's what I meant. But yeah, you know, I mean, so $28,000 like is still a sum that some professional families could put together for a lump sum payment. And then undergrad is completely taken care of if they go in state. You know, you can also pay like $170 a month. So that's like the prepaid option if you think your kid's going to go in state. You can also do a 529 plan. So that's like a college savings plan. You basically open that up, put money in, you can use the earnings tax-free for tuition expenses. And so that's just basically you're investing in the stock market and you can use it at a lot more places. Then also, Florida had a Bright Futures scholarship that would cover 100% tuition at a state school when I was there. And Georgia has a Hope scholarship, doesn't it?
Yep.
So maybe you can talk about that state scholarship.
Yeah. So the Georgia Hope Scholarship, wildly popular and wildly sought out, I think, by parents who have kids who are about to go into school, or at least that's what I've seen. I may have changed since I've been in school, but it was, you know, if you had a GPA average of, I think it was 3.5 or higher in high school, you graduated with that GPA and you maintain that through school, through college, then 100% of tuition in school, in state tuition was covered for a public university, I believe.
Go Dogs.
Yeah. And I went to Kennesaw State, so it was the same for Kennesaw. When I started college, they changed the program a little bit. I think they dropped it down from 100% to 90%, or, you know, something like that. And now I think it's a little different even today. But basically, it rewards people who have good grades in high school and who maintain good grades through college. So I think it's a great, you know, there's lots of scholarship opportunities potentially statewide that are similar to this, but that was something that was really attractive for folks here in Georgia who wanted to stay here and go to school in Georgia.
Yeah, and Florida has a similar program. And I'm going to be a little controversial here. This is a fantastic program for upper middle class white people, right? Right. Because just being real, right? Like if you look at the requirements, like in Florida, you have to get like a 1270 or above, I think, on the SAT to get the 100% version. And so, you know, if you look at the beneficiaries of this, this is primarily middle class, disproportionately white because of the standardized test requirements that have higher, you have more beneficiaries of that, you know, in the sort of middle class white background, right? Because, you know, you have the discussion of like discrimination with standardized test scores against underrepresented minorities. Mm-hmm. And then also, it's funded usually by the lottery. In most cases, at least in Florida, it was. And who does the lottery really benefit from? Usually like lower income, more disproportionately minority, right? People sometimes call the lottery the math tax because, you know, it's basically gambling. And this really does hit the budgets of like lower income people disproportionately hard. So I'm not going to say that it's a great program, like in the sense of it's basically redistributing wealth from the poor to people who in many cases probably didn't need it. I didn't need Bright Futures to go to school. I'm glad that I got it. Don't get me wrong, like hot dog, you know, but I'll say this though, the old people playing the lottery in Florida, I am so down to redistribute wealth from them to me because we are not going to get, you know, to piss some people off for a second, like Social Security is so freaking generous for the people who, like, if you need it, that's one thing. Like if you're living only on Social Security, fine. But like the people who like don't really need it and like think like my dad, like to think that his Social Security taxes paid for his Social Security, like actuarially, when it probably paid for like a fifth of the benefits that he's getting. Sorry, Dad, I'm down to redistribute like crazy. You know what I mean? from you. So, you know, but anyways, like, so if you get one of these, you have state scholarships, you have merit scholarships. Like I applied to my credit union and got one. I applied for like a specific program at our school and got it. And so with the prepaid scholarship, with the fact that these states also gave a state scholarship program, basically I was able to stack scholarships. There's nothing unethical about this. You figure out how the game is played and you play the game. That's what I did. And so I was able to get above the cost of attendance, which paid for tuition, room, board, the occasional keg of Natty Light,
pizza,
pizza, you know, I'm just being honest, right? Like, but that's how you go to school debt-free in undergrad. It's like target a low-cost state, maybe, if you can relocate. I'm sorry, but like Penn State at like 25 grand a year is not a good deal compared to Florida at 6 grand a year.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, New Jersey, not a good deal compared to probably University of Oklahoma, where like to be a national merit scholar in New Jersey, like with all that competition, you have to be like a freaking genius. Whereas in Oklahoma, you just have to be able to do a decent job and like you're a national merit, you know. I'm just kidding. Cause like, you know, national merit's also very state driven, you know, in terms of you have to be in the top percentage of your state. And it's a lot more competitive in California and New Jersey than it is in like an out of the way place. So anyways, like you could relocate to a lower cost of place and have your kid go in state. And that's how you can keep your debt to almost nothing for undergrad. I also wanted to mention my friend Jocelyn has this site called thescholarshipsystem.com and she helps people search for scholarships. So you can get a lot of scholarships.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's what her business is. So she's like the anti-student loan planner, right?
Right.
So, you know, thanks Jocelyn for trying to keep me from having paying customers. Jeez. So let's talk about grad school because that'll all sound a little bit more competent on.
Oh, wait. I do want to mention just maybe another strategy that I took in college. So I think scholarships are maybe an underrated form of paying for college. I think take a couple hours on a Saturday, make your kid apply for a ton of different programs through the school, the state, different organizations, maybe career-oriented scholarships. But another thing that I don't think should be discounted is you can work while you're in school, or the student can work while you're in school to pay for your cost of living. So I did this in my college career. All 4 years of my undergrad, I worked full-time. And I tell people that sometimes, and sometimes people are like, how did you do that? And at the end of the day, I think I don't know. I don't think I'm abnormal. I really don't. I think people can have the time to work at least part-time. And with that, I was able to cover my rent because I did move out to Kennesaw from where I grew up. And, you know, I paid for rent. I paid for my groceries. I paid for my gas and my car. You know, I was living on beans and rice, but I didn't pull out student loans that were unnecessary because I covered that cost with what I was earning in my job. And I also think a benefit to that is you get like real life experience when you're working. And I went into finance because of my college job. Well, I liked finance before then too, but I think it really sealed the deal when I worked at a gym facility and I did their bookkeeping. And I really loved like looking at the P&L and understanding how the numbers worked and how to run a business. And so that's why I went to, you know, I got my degree in a business degree, but a concentration in finance. And that's what led me to that decision. So I like to talk about that too, because that's not something your kid can't do. Your kid or you as a student can find a job making some income. Potentially, it could be a great opportunity to help dictate what your career is going to be if you're unsure.
That's true. I will say, though, that it's a lot harder to join the Rowdy Reptiles, which was the student group that watched basketball every time they had a basketball game, and then to watch Bradley Beal go off and score like 40 points on his way to an illustrious career with the Washington Wizards. So I don't know if anybody got that reference, but I will say this. At the end of the day, like, going to college is a great decision financially. It's unnecessary for a lot of people, yes. Could I have been successful without a college degree? Hopefully. But at the same time, if you're smart about it, you know, you can go multiple ways. There's no like wrong path. For me, I'm going to be honest, I was too lazy to, you know, go work at a, you know, full-time or part-time job. I did actually work, but I worked as a TA and a research assistant. Like, my goal is like to get relevant experience, like in the sense of like, I was trying to basically say, well, if I'm going to work, I want to only have it be something related to my field. And that might be harder to do. I knew some people worked as lab assistants. There's a lot of different things you can do. I mean, again, you have to get creative. The problem is when we go into grad school, that ability to be creative, it's like, oh, great. How do I come up with $100,000 for dental school? I guess you can't make $100,000 a year. It's just not possible while you're in school. So like, you can talk about working, but if you work, you're going to make like 20 grand. Let's be honest. If you're borrowing $100,000 a year, I hope it's because it's very, very freaking important what you're learning. And so it would be foolish to go make $20,000 a year, which would detract from your ability and time to study and learn the skills that you need to learn to be a successful professional, to make an income to justify borrowing that in the first place. So grad school is different because grad school assumes there's no ties financially to your parents anymore. You can borrow approximately $20,000 for Stafford unsubsidized loans per year. You can borrow about 40 grand if you're going to medical, dental school, some other health professions, but those degrees cost a lot more than 40 grand per year. So now we have the Grad Plus loan. So maybe you can talk to folks about what the Grad Plus loan is, Megan, and how that's different from the Stafford unsubsidized.
Yeah. So right off the bat, the interest rates will be different. Grad Plus loans are typically a little higher, similar to Parent Plus loans. Parent Plus loans are typically higher than Grad Plus loans, but generally anything with a plus in it is going to be plus the interest rate. But so that's one thing. Also similar to Parent Plus loans, Graduate Plus loans, you can borrow, again, up to the cost of attendance. And so there's not necessarily a limit on how much you can pull out as long as it's up to that cost of attendance threshold. And so that's oftentimes a place people will run right after their unsubsidized bucket is tapped out. And so that's why you'll see oftentimes for graduate students, two types of loans on their loan list. There are no such thing, as you mentioned at the beginning, as subsidized loans for graduate students. So you'll see potentially your unsubsidized loan and your plus loan on your loan list for each semester.
So you can borrow unlimited, right?
Yeah. Up to the cost of attendance. Yeah.
I mean, so which is just sort of an arbitrary number that they can just pay. So You can borrow as much as you want up to the cost of attendance. And so the schools get to set this. So this is kind of like the fox guarding the chicken coop, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a great reference. Yes.
I mean, you know, you can give as much as you want and then it's like you can set it to whatever. So as long as people are willing to borrow it, that's the only resistance. You're paying the same fixed percent of your income, regardless if you're borrowing $100,000 or a million.
That's correct. Yep.
And so as long as your net earnings after paying 10% for your student loans are higher than what they would have been without the degree, then that was a good decision to borrow that amount of money, no matter what it was. I had this thought on another podcast, which I thought it was kind of an interesting thought. So you know how like the price earnings ratio exists in the stock market, and like long-term it's been like 15 price earnings ratio, but now it's like a lot higher because you have all these tech companies and people are paying like 100 times earnings for Amazon and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the idea is that Amazon is so much better than the alternative, right? Which is to own like the bricks and mortar retail, which is like dying off like the dinosaurs. So I kind of think this is what's happening with higher education, where like the price to earnings ratio of higher education is going way up. Because everything is going way up. The value of assets is going way up, and education is an asset. So like, my thought process on this is, what is the benefit of like an $80,000 a year stable degree that, absent a pandemic, is gonna, you know, it's going to be fairly steady. And even in this pandemic, all the low income people got furloughed. right? Like most of the job losses are in that sub 50K income range. People that have higher incomes, like my wife's a physician, she's going to get hit, but she's going to get a 20% pay cut or something like that. That stinks, but hey, that's still a six-figure income. So, you know, what's the price to pay for an $80,000 a year stable job with globalization that's like causing so much stress for people's finances? The answer maybe is like previously you might have been willing to pay 1x annual salary for that. But now people are willing to pay 2 or 3x annual salary because, you know, the value of that asset has gone up a lot because of the anxiety about globalization and all that. And then also the ability to pay that fixed price where it's like the same percent of your, you know, net earnings or the same, you know, 10% of your earnings. So it's like you're always going to have people under this current screwed up system that we have that are like, back up the truck, load it up, you know? I mean, is that fair?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And what's interesting is from a repayment perspective, it works in your favor. This may sound crazy, but you know, if you're borrowing way more than 1x what your potential income is going to be, you know, naturally, if you're thinking about debt, you're thinking, oh my goodness, this is going to be bad on the repayment side of things. This is going to cost me a lot. I'm going to be in debt forever. I'm never going to retire. But how the federal system works, it almost doesn't matter, because if you have access to income-driven repayment plans, you know, you can pursue the longer term forgiveness, or if you're, you know, your career takes you to public service, you can pursue that and treat the debt more like a tax instead of a debt. And so after a certain point, you know, if your cost of education is going to cost you, you know, 1, 2, 3x your income, at that point, it doesn't really matter how much more you're borrowing, because your cost over time is going to be about the same if you're pursuing forgiveness. Is that a good way to maybe put that concept?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that I don't think that people have any incentive to care about the cost other than psychological strain.
Yes.
You know, you do have to pay a tax bomb on the forgiven debt, but like we've talked about in a lot, like I just don't think the tax bomb is going to happen. Or if it is, it's not going to hit people nearly as hard as what the current rules of the game are.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, by the time they figured out what they did, it's going to be like too late and they're just going to have to rescue people. I mean, that's just kind of the reality. In terms of when we're advising somebody like that's looking at going to a graduate program, it's really like this. It's like, well, how happy are you with your life now? What would you do if you didn't go down this road and become this thing? And a lot of times the answer we hear is like, oh man, I really don't know. Like I would have a really hard time. And I'm like, well, okay, what are your passions? And usually what we hear is I've always wanted to be a veterinarian, or, you know, I've dreamed about being a dentist since I was 5 years old. It's just the cost that's holding me back. And when we hear that, it's like, well, let's explain what this is going to look like. You're going to go this, this, and this, like you're in a relationship or something, you know, you're engaged and you're thinking about going to this university, but it's a lot more expensive and you're worried because your significant other is going to have to live in another state. You explain, well, actually go to the high cost school, it sounds counterintuitive, but if you have $300,000 in dental school debt and $500,000, you're actually in a pretty similar place, because you're going to go for forgiveness probably either way. Right. Now, if you have 150, then yeah, you might really think twice about going to the one that's 500 versus the one that's 150. But I think a lot of people don't realize there's not that big of a difference between 2x your debt and 3x your debt. There's a huge difference between 1x your debt and 2x your debt.
Yes.
Because the 1x your debt can actually be paid back and should be paid back in most cases. So I don't know. I mean, thoughts about that? Like, you know, I think it's kind of interesting to think about, because like, you know, somebody that doesn't understand student loan rules might just say like, well, obviously 3x your debt is like way worse than 2x, but it's not. Isn't that weird?
It's not. Yeah. And I have to tell people all the time that federal student loan debt is not like traditional debt. We cannot treat it or think about it like a traditional debt, because there are things you can take advantage of within the federal system that work in your favor hugely. And so it's always kind of coming back to that realization that $300,000 worth of student loan debt in the federal system, pursuing a longer term forgiveness route or just forgiveness in general, mathematically might be, you know, a better strategy than paying it all off or stressing about pulling that out in general and trying to penny pinch. And I had a consult recently where talking to someone who was going, they were going to be a physician, and the cost of their program was like $85,000 a year. they had an estimate on how much they thought they were going to make post-graduation and residency and once they hit attending. And they were intending, they were intentionally wanting to work in public service. And so the dad was on the phone as well. The mom was there and they were asking all about these scholarship opportunities and trying to throw down their life savings to pay for this. And I'm talking through like, no, let's back up for a second and just take advantage of how the federal system works. If you're pursuing PSLF, and this would have worked too if he went the longer term route towards forgiveness. But, you know, if you're pursuing this forgiveness route or federal loans in general, if you were to just pay this all out of pocket or, you know, really stress yourself out about living at home with your parents or, you know, penny pinching for that 4-year timeframe, that's not going to make a difference at the end of the day. When we look at your repayment strategy, if you save yourself $100,000 by, you know, maybe knocking off some of the balance with scholarships or with throwing some money towards it, at the end of the day, it didn't really change the math at all because his income-driven payment is going to be based off of income, not the balance, not the term, nothing, just income. And so we walked through that and I said, you can certainly have at it, try to subsidize the cost of your aid here. But at the end of the day, on your repayment side of things, it's not going to make a difference. And I thought that was really interesting. And it was interesting just hearing them kind of that click in their head and walking through like the math of it. So I thought that was a fun consult, actually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like the pre-debt consult is kind of like making sure people don't have anxiety while they're going through it.
Yeah.
It's really about like making sure you make the right financing decisions, which can save you 5 or 6 figures. And then it's also about making sure that you know why you're doing what you're doing and you've reviewed everything and you understand like why you're trying to do this particular path and financing it this specific way. Like, so for my wife's parents, my in-laws, they poured into her financing of her medical education. They probably put in some small 6-figure sum over 4 years, right? And so that delayed their retirement by 1 or 2 years. And if they had known about PSLF, if they had optimized for that, if my wife had known about PSLF, they could have retired 2 years sooner. And, you know, he wakes up at 4 in the morning to drive to New York City for his job. And it's a very intense physical strain on somebody who's in his 60s. You know what I mean? And so you think about that, that's a huge impact. That's a huge cost that they could have lived a life that is just way less stressful if they had known the rules, and they didn't. And so that cost them dearly. And then we also see people that will go to a 400K dental school and they're second generation and their parents have very good intentions and they mortgage their house. They literally give away half of their home equity for $200,000 to cover half the cost of their dental school. And it's like, when you see those things, you're just like, that is so sad, you know? And then you see similar stories of people, okay, I think I have a consult coming up where somebody has like several hundred thousand of that they owe to like a parent or a grandparent or something, and then a lot smaller amount for federal loans. And it's like, that could have been forgiven. You know, you could have taken that $400,000 as just literally an inheritance and put it into index funds and been 2 or 3 times as wealthy long term, you know, compared to the decision to finance the loan. So it's like people just do what they think is the right thing based off what they've heard on the radio or on a podcast or on, you know, TV. And it's like, wait a second, we do thousands of student loan plans a year. Like, these people are just sort of talking.
Yeah, we know what it's going to look like on the back end one way or another. So we could tell you, you know, if you decided to go that route versus this route, we'll be able to illustrate it for you and let you decide.
Well, an income-based repayment is a Pandora's box that's been opened that can't be closed. You know, they can make it less generous. I expect that there will be a lot of wrangling over what the future terms of new loans will be because it is too generous. Like, if you think about paying 10% of your income, especially if they take away the tax bomb, that's transparent. Like let's set away like the political aspects of this. Paying 10% of your income for a degree where there's no cap on borrowing at all, that is a transparently stupid system.
Yeah.
That is stupid. And why is it stupid? It's just because nobody cares about the cost and like there's no regulation on the schools at all. So if you're progressive, you don't like that there's literally zero regulation. These schools are basically just like kind of like Wall Street banks. They can just do whatever the heck they want to do. And if you're a conservative, then it's like your worst fears realized. Like, you know, getting a federal government involvement in a program drastically jacks up the cost of everything. Whether you're, you know, liberal, conservative, progressive, or libertarian, it doesn't really matter. Like, this is a bad system. That said, you can't undo the ability to pay based on your income because it's too deeply ingrained in our law, where like IBR is an act of Congress and the Senate would have to be okay with repealing that. And you're never going to get 60 senators to agree on that. I mean, you could get a majority that would agree to tweak the terms and make it less generous or more generous potentially. So I don't know. I mean, I think that my guess long-term is I think they make it more generous. Like, I think they make pay-as-you-earn available for everybody and take away the tax bomb. And then I think fast forward another 10 years and they realize like, wait a second, this benefit is primarily going to people that have the highest debts, high incomes, highly educated people. Right. This is not progressive. And so I think you see like a kind of a backlash among progressives where it's like, let's take care of like lower income people, but let's make it a progressive tax system. Like, we're, instead of charging 10% for people making above 100K, we're going to charge 20% of their incomes, right? And so that's going to incentivize like higher income people to like actually borrow like based off of like pushing back on the cost. I don't know. I think that that would be kind of like the long-term thing, like 50 years down the road. That's what I would guess, is that you'll have some sort of thing where like higher education for like maybe public schools or public universities and lower cost programs for like lower income people will be free. And then, you know, the med school, dental school kind of degrees, those will eventually, they'll realize, oh, wait a second, like expanding tuition prices at faster than inflation forever doesn't work. So anyways, like, so some key costs for graduate school, there's cost of attendance, which is the biggest one, but then you have tuition inflation. There's probably not going to be tuition inflation right now because there should be tuition cuts. And so universities are just going to basically not change tuition for probably 1 or 2 years to try to look like they're not doing anything bad. Whereas like in reality, they should be cutting tuition right now, but they're not going to. So I think I viewed like the 0% tuition increases that universities will in many cases choose to do this year. I think it's just going to be more of like a, they're terrified about having to make cuts. So maybe if they do zero, they can get back to the normal 5% increase later. So that's one component they don't cover. Origination fees, Megan. So you mentioned like, what are the origination fees for Stafford and Grad Plus?
Stafford and Grad Plus, I know they just changed though, right? Or was that the interest rate on top of that?
They're pretty consistent, like with the origination fees. Like, it's generally 1% for Stafford and 4.25% for Grad Plus.
Yeah. So that's in addition what you'll pay with the interest added on top of that.
Yeah. So that's like an upfront cost, those origination fees. People don't get that's like straight off the top. You borrow 100 grand, 4,250 goes to the government first, but you still owe 100.
Right.
You know, and you only get 95,000, whatever. And then the accrued interest. So this is interesting. So the accrued interest grows, simple interest, not compound, but it's still a lot. That first 50,000 that you borrow, take 6% of that, you know, it's 3,000 a year. So you're going to get charged that for 4 years of school. So 3,000 times four. And then the next year, you know, you're borrowing another 50,000. Well, that's 3,000 times three. So you add up all those accrued interest costs. And then also the accrued interest is also increasing because you're borrowing more every year because of tuition inflation. And so that's another issue. So usually we find you take the cost of attendance that includes everything and multiply it by 1.25, and you get a good estimate for what the cost of attendance will actually be with you walking out the door, how much student debt are you going to have?
Post-graduation,
yeah. So, you know, if you're going to owe $400,000, if that's the projected cost of attendance for your program, then it's actually going to be more like 500, you know, and that's if the cost of attendance is listed at what it is today. Now, what happens is the school quotes you the average debt. Have you seen this, Megan? Like, where the school will say, our average student has $185,000 in debt, but that's from the class, that's the most recent stat available. So that's for the class of 2019. And that's off of the tuition prices that were available from 2015 to 2019. Yeah. And then also that's averaging in a lot of the people that had spousal assistance or parent assistance with the costs that are only borrowing for like 1 year, or that's including like the military, you know, students that had the 3 or 4 year scholarship that had to pay for 1 year out of pocket and they borrowed 50K.
Right.
Right. So you average all those people in, and it doesn't take a ton of those people in a class to really skew that average debt number downwards. It's kind of unbelievable. It's like, I had one person that got mad at me from some vet school who was like, why are you spreading misinformation on your blog? Just, you know, you told one of your commenters that she was going to leave with 300,000 of vet school debt. How outrageous. Like, just recently we had someone graduate with, you know, 150,000 from our school. So I ran the math and I was like, I know this place doesn't give scholarships. So I was like, oh, I said, so great. So I was like, so are you providing the rich parents or do they come with those already pre-built? And then I said, and furthermore, you're right. I was wrong. It's not 300,000. It's 400,000. Cause I looked at the cost and I forgot to include the out of state, you know, differential for tuition.
Did they ever respond to you or no?
After they realized they were an idiot, I think they stopped responding. But I don't know. I'm not a very sensitive person. I'm trying to work on my empathy, Megan.
I wish I was a little more like you. I think I'm too sensitive sometimes.
I don't know. I guess I don't suffer fools well.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I can be a fool on certain things for sure. When it comes to certain things, I'm total ignoramus. Like it's like cooking, I'm embarrassing, you know. Other things like fixing a car, I'm calling AAA, you know what I mean? Or I'm calling Geico, right? So it's definitely, but the thing is, the difference is, and hopefully I'm not trying to sound super authoritative about something I don't know anything about, right? You don't know something, you try to be like, yep, don't know anything about that at all. So don't take me seriously. Like, so that's kind of interesting. So very few people save more than half their income. I think it's probably like 5% of people or less save more than half their income. And when you take out more than twice your income, you have to basically have a 50% savings rate to be able to pay it back, right? And so when you're borrowing more than your income, especially more than double your income, you're setting yourself up for a no exceptions, basically loan payback strategy where you have to use forgiveness. Most likely, you're not going to be willing to live with your mom in the basement for 10 years. And that's also interesting. We see a lot of people that are like, oh, I'm living at home right now. Like I'm saving up a lot. Like I made some extra payments to my loans, but the balance didn't really change that much. And it's like, well, yeah, if you have $2,000 of rental savings a month and you've done this for 6 months, that's $12,000 towards your loans, which are, you know, 300 grand generating 20 grand a year in interest. I mean, that's why it's not changed at all, right? And you're on, the pay plan instead of the repay plan. And so you weren't getting the interest subsidies. So you've already cost yourself 10 grand with that, right? So it's like, so, you know, you really have to be aware that you choosing to go to a specific degree program has huge implications for what your financial future looks like. And it doesn't need to be a scary thing. If you go into it knowing that, yes, I'm going to have to do forgiveness. Yes, this is a screwed up system, but I'm going to make, you know, my expected salary, take away 10% of it for loans, 5% of it for my tax bomb. That expected salary, once you do all the math, is way higher than what you would make as an undergrad with your bachelor's degree. And you have job stability and it allows you to live the life you want to live, which is we ask the client what their ideal life looks like. And they'll say, well, I just want to have a nice place to live, you know, have a nice family, be married to the person I'm dating right now. And I want to live close to my friends and family in central Jersey, right? Like I just want to have a good life and, you know, help people. I enjoy dentistry. I enjoy veterinary medicine. I've always wanted to be a physician. I've always wanted to do legal work. You know, so you hear that sometimes. And then you do hear, if we hear something that we need to push back on, right? Like you push back hard. Like for me, if I hear somebody that's like, they have wanderlust and like they want to travel the world and they have all these interests and they're really unsure about what they want to do. Holy cow, like go take a trip to like when all this pandemic stuff is over, go travel, go to Europe, go to Asia, go to Africa, South America, like go hit the road and try to figure out more of like what you want out of life.
Right. Press pause and assess that before you commit yourself.
Yeah. The pause button is a fantastic button to press. And it's a great button to press for mental health reasons too. I've advised some people who were having some mental health crises over the amount of debt that they were borrowing, because it's one thing to hear all the math and hear that it's okay. But then it's another thing to sign your name to the 100K, you know, I mean, so I get that there's a little bit of a disconnect there. And, but this person's taken that year off. They messaged me actually recently and they're like, wow, I really wish I hadn't taken the year off. I would be 1 year closer to what I want to do. I think that's great. That's wonderful. You telling me that is like the perfect reason and exactly how you would want a year off to go. You press the reset button. You realize what you really want, which is to continue getting your degree and becoming that professional, and you get back to it. And I said, plus, I said, by delaying your graduation by a year, you're probably going to, that last year of graduation that you've added on to your education, you're going to get a lot better education from that year. Do you know what I mean? Like compared to the pandemic education that's going on right now.
Yeah, very true.
Semester is awful. Fall semester is going to be awful. You're going to be receiving way less value than what you're paying for than the sticker price, even though the schools will tell you that they, you know, that's ridiculous, right? Like, no, like, you know, if you're paying 50 grand or 100 grand a year for something in school is going to have way more value than like a Zoom call, especially if you're in some sort of health profession. Like, I don't get how you can even do remote instruction for some of these things, yeah. You know? So he adds on this year, like, you know, 2022, 2023, where, you know, and so anybody who's thinking about deferring too, you know, unless your school is raring to go or something, if the caseload continues to fall and travel restrictions really start going away, if I was single and you know, 1 or 2 years in school, I would consider taking a deferral for a year if I could. I mean, I don't know. What would you do, Megan?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think, again, I was a weirdo. I really liked working. So if I were to take a year off or press pause, I'd probably like explore maybe a different area of finance, or like I would have maybe looked at other internship opportunities potentially. But I don't know. I'm not a good example for that, I don't think. I've always been down to work, always been down to just, I was actually ready. I was so ready to be done with school because I was so excited to just get into the workforce and start my career. So I'm a horrible example for this.
Yeah, it's okay. I mean, I think at the end of the day, like, you need to do what you're comfortable with. And most people, that's going to mean finishing on time.
Yeah.
Because great time to be in school when earnings are down and the job market's super stressful, right? If you're a first or second year in a four-year program, what a great time to be in school.
True. Yeah. Don't have to deal with it yet.
Well, yeah, the opportunity cost is going to be a lot less, and like your job market's probably going to look a lot better than the people above you, right? If you're a rising fourth year for this fall, it's going to be hard. There's two things are going to happen. This was a huge overreaction, and the economy starts going gangbusters again, and everybody starts getting hired back super fast, and we start having this bidding war kind of like it was pre-corona, or we have a continuation and a slow rebound, or we have like a heaven forbid, a second wave, right? And we have to do all this shutdown all over again, in which case all bets are off. But as a dentist or veterinarian or mental health counselor or lawyer or corporate person or whatever you are, you're in much better shape with your education than you probably would be without it. Some people, that's not true, but most people, that's true. And most people that have this higher level of education will be way better off in an extended economic crisis than you would have been if you are not having those advanced education skills.
Right.
Even people talking about like programming and stuff like that. Like, I heard a really interesting take that the secret plan for like all of the Twitter and Facebook things where they're saying, you know, you can choose to work from home permanently. The real reason is because long-term they want to see if they can get the same product out of somebody remote versus in person. And if they can, there's zero reason why they need to hire an American in North Dakota. They could just hire an Indian programmer in India for a fraction of the cost. It's going to be as good or even better.
Yeah. No brick and mortar offices either. Reduce expenses there.
Right. Which enhances their profitability even more. The one thing I feel pretty confident on is the last thing that's going to get digitized is root canals.
Oh gosh.
I mean, the last thing that's going to get digitized, right, is the pelvic exams that my wife does when, you know, her patients are having problems. Like, I don't want to go into it because it's for non-medical people. It's kind of like, oh
yeah. But if you're in a practice where you are practicing a profession, you're right. I mean, there's little to no chance to that turning virtual at some point.
It's just not going to happen, right? So yeah, we have awful shutdowns that happened. Yeah, 60% of our dentist clients and readers were unemployed at one point at the height of it in April. That's horrible. But there was all these stimulus stuff. There was PPP. There was enhanced unemployment benefits, right? You hopefully were able to save more money than somebody that was making 40, 30, 20K a year. So I just think that, again, no matter how bad you think you are off, you're actually in great shape. And if you did make a bad decision, then you might need to do a pre-debt plan to think about going back and getting another degree to do something else. And I've talked about that in a different podcast, and that's a really mind-blowing kind of thing. Because, you know, you can look into whether or not it makes sense to go back and get a second professional degree and do a career change. In a lot of cases, it does.
Yeah.
So anyways, we've talked a lot. We've gone a little over time, but it's just so much fun talking, Megan. And I hope the readers give me grace on my awful jokes. So sometimes I hope that, I don't make too many ears bleed out there. But anyways, so the thing that we do for people, and if this doesn't apply to you, please share it with a friend that could benefit from it, right? We always hear people, all these clients, like, oh man, I would have killed to know this stuff when I was in school.
Beforehand, yeah.
This would have saved me so much pain. This would have saved my relationship. This would have allowed me to live in the same state as my significant other. This would have allowed my parents to not mortgage their house. They could have retired on time. We hear these things all the time. So if it doesn't apply to you, please share it with a friend because it's going to apply to somebody. But studentloanplanner.com/predebt, just P-R-E-D-E-T, D-E-B-T. Yep, I can't spell.
We're good at math, not spelling.
Yeah, I know. studentloanplanner.com/P-R-E-D-E-B-T. Predebt, no dash or anything, just one word, predebt. And if you do that, it's basically $395. You're working with Ben, our resident CPA, or Megan. And you're coming up with a plan of what the debt will look like specifically for your situation, kind of customized to the outlook for salaries based off of the area of the country you want to live. Because at this point, we have thousands of professions income data for different parts of the country. So we have a pretty good idea for most professions what realistic earning numbers are. You know, so get that if you think that you want to plan for before you graduate, for before you start borrowing, you know, a whole bunch of debt for professional school. So that's a great thing to do. And you're going to get a view that you're just not going to be able to get from the financial aid office that wants you to sign up so they can get paid. So anything that I missed there, Megan, any last thoughts for being responsible with student loan debt on the front end?
I think we've covered a big chunk of it. Maybe last comment would just be talking about what this will look like on the back end is strategy. It's preparing you for the most important part of borrowing aid, and that's the repayment side of it. What is that going to look like? How are we going to be most efficient with it? What are things to avoid? What are things to take into account? Like you mentioned before, I think this does help, you know, just bring a lot of peace of mind to folks who are not familiar with the system in general. And now is the time to start to get familiar with it, because I think it can bring a lot of peace of mind and ease while you're going through school, doing something that, you know, you're passionate about. And I love when people leave these calls and they don't feel bad about their decision anymore to pursue what they really wanted to do. Because I feel like that's what debt does to people. It makes people feel embarrassed or bad or sad, or we can shine the light on how it doesn't necessarily have to make you feel that way.
That's right. And last thing, go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail to leave a question for one of our future podcast episodes. I would love to get more questions from you. I know you have a question. I know you want to ask it, so do it. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. And thank you so much, Megan, for being on the show.
Thank you.